Ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome to Sellersville Theater, the golden voice of the great Southwest, Hugh Utah Phillips.
Call me Fishbeal. Good evening. And it's good to see y'all. Good to see y'all. There he is. I leave home so seldom these days out in Nevada City, California. It's wonderful to be here in this part of the world. You know, I did this today. I visited Our Lady of Częstochowa. My wife is a Catholic, and she's studying the Black Madonnas, so I could take her some things about that. And of course, the fellow take me around, Pete, lived here most of his life. He's never seen the Mercer Museum. I had the privilege of taking him there. That's not a one. Have you spent much time there? You can learn a whole trade there. Man, I love that place. Oh, this trade is like being paid to go to school. You know, it always was. And every town is its own teacher. You've got to beat the streets and look at things. Yeah, it was, is, and will continue to be a pleasure to be anywhere. Especially as we tread the thin line between misfortune and calamity. What might that be? Well, if J. Edgar Ashcroft was to be out walking by the reflecting pool in on the mall in Washington and accidentally trip and fall in, that would be a misfortune. If anybody was to happen by and pull him out, that would be a calamity. A railroad along the great divide, nothing around me but the Rockies and the sky. It's there you find me as years go by. I'm railroad along the great divide. Onset, those of you who may have heard me should probably turn to those who may have not and calmly reassure them this is in fact what happens when I sit on a stage. Not much more. This is about it. You will notice no sudden or dramatic change in my instrumental or vocal attack, as it were. Nice to know there are some things in early 21st century American technology that don't change very fast. I am one of those. Now, this is nonetheless an American folk song. Did you recognize it as such? Don't hear them much anymore, do you? Don't hear them on your AM radio, huh? Folk singers hardly ever sing them. That's because they're boring. Folk music is boring. Whack, fall the dido, blow ye winds, hi-ho, hell, that's boring. But this is a folk song. This is a program of folk music. I'm a folk singer. You're ostensibly the folk, Nespa. That means we own this song together, right? Right? Yeah. It's ours, damn it. You know, we have thereby inherited certain social obligations which we will faithfully discharge. We're going to sing this damn song together, boring or not. Got it? Now, those of you who don't sing, I'll see to it personally that a Mormon missionary is sent to each of your homes. Now, I don't want to have to remind you again that in a mass marketing economy, a revolutionary song is any song you choose to sing yourself. Welcome to the revolution. Railroading on the Great Divide, nothing around me but the Rockies and sky. Is there you'll find me as years go by, railroading on the Great Divide, huh? Hey, railroading on the Great Divide, nothing around me but the Rockies and sky. Is there you find me as years go by, railroading on the Great Divide. doesn't work. The machine age, anything that has moving parts, I make a Luddite look like an astronaut. Yeah, I don't hardly travel much at all. It's very unusual for me to come this far away from my home in Nevada City, California, up in the foothills of the Sierra. I got grounded some time back because of this congestive heart failure, and I had to stay home. But I've been really working at it. I take the cardiac rehab exercise class 3 days a week at the hospital, and a really good diet, rigorous diet, proper medication, meditation, exercise, and I'm feeling pretty good, matter of fact. And I felt good enough to be able to leave home once a month, and this is your month. I like that a lot. And I do feel good, but now see, at the intermission, I'll be hanging out with you all there in the back. And I do not want anybody coming up to me with sage advice about heart disease. I don't want any folk cures. I don't want any colloidal suspension of silver, goddammit. Nevada City, California is the new age chronosynclastic infundibulum of the world, the epicenter. It's a new age town. I mean, there's so many healers there, it makes me sick. I have a Zen acupuncturist, wears a blindfold, uses darts. I love it. There's a psychologist over there on Commercial Street. They want to charge me $100, suspend me in a tank of water in pitch darkness. Some therapy, I think it's called, a sensory deprivation. $100. I said, I could listen to Leonard Cohen records, get the same thing for nothing. Well, my wife and I, hedging our bets, have invested in a timeshare mausoleum. That's a weird idea. Half the year you're in somebody's garage. No, it really is a new age town. We have a little Catholic church there, a little board church built in about 1852, and it is the only Catholic church I know, where my wife goes, St. Canis, that has low fiber or high fiber and low calorie communion wafers. They're called I Can't Believe It's Not Jesus. In 1914, I started to roam out through Wyoming, no money, no home. And I was drifting along with the tide. I landed out over the Great Divide. Harry rolled on the Great Divide. Nothing around me but the Rockies and skies. It's there you find me as years go by. I'm railroading on the Great Divide. Well, it is a world gradually sinking into turmoil, is it not? I have no sage advice to offer to you about how to rectify the average annual ambient dilapidated appearance of reality. Some aphorisms, perhaps, garnered over the years from minds far more astute than mine. Lucy Parsons, anybody remember the name Lucy Parsons? The Haymarket, 1886, the beginning of the fight for the 8-hour day. Lucy Parsons lived well up into this century, and she was at the founding convention of the Industrial Workers of the World. That's our table over there, my union table. And she stood up at that convention, 1905, and she said, "Never be deceived that the rich will permit you to vote away their wealth." Yeah, think about that. Or there was old Oscar Ameringer. He was down in Cincinnati along about the same time. And Oscar, he said, "Now, politicians get money from the rich and votes from the poor on the guarantee to protect each from the other." Old Idaho Blackie, that old wobbly out in Post Falls, Idaho, where I used to cut my wood when I was living in Spokane, had a little earthier view of things. He'd say,
politicians, most of them's so crooked they gotta screw their socks on in the morning. So damn dumb they couldn't pour piss out of a boot if the instructions was wrote on the heel. He was a case. Yeah, he'd say, politics. Holly is Greek for many, and ticks are blood-sucking insects. Stick your head out the window and see how it feels. Number nine's a-coming the fastest on wheels. At 90 an hour, she whistles with pride. Thunders out over the Great Divide. Now, hey, Ray Roden on the Great Divide. Nothing around me but the Rockies and sky. It's there you find me as years go by, railroading on the Great Divide. Well, since I am marooned out there in Nevada City, little town of about 2,700 people, and I like it because I can know everybody in town, walk in the streets. But most of my time I spend doing radio. I fell in love with radio. We have a really good community station where I live, KVMR. Been there over 20 years. Little station. But I've been doing a radio show that goes out over Pacifica Network from KPFA and Berkeley called Loafer's Glory, the Hobo Jungle of the Mind. You ever heard that? Nobody plays it around here.
Can you get it on the web?
Yes. Oh, yeah, you can get it over KVMR is on the web, and then KBOO in Portland and KGNU in Boulder. They do it. Okay. That's bad, but I don't know. Well, let me tell you a radio story. I love radio. I fell in love with it. I was over there in San Diego some years ago, and I was sharing a park bench with a fellow by the name of Hank Penny. Now, Hank Penny was in the early days of radio, right? It's sort of long about the beginning. And he was a banjo player and a storyteller, played the guitar, kind of like an early Grandpa Jones. Well, he told me sitting on the park bench that he was on the first coast-to-coast radio broadcast in the history of the universe. It emanated from Camden, New Jersey, and the spot was sponsored by Standard Oil of New Jersey, and he was there for that broadcast live for the first time, you know, coast-to-coast, the first time anybody's going to talk to a lot of people at the same time. The master of ceremonies was the great Will Rogers. Well, Hank was walking around tuning his banjo, waiting to go on the air, and he overheard a conversation between Will Rogers and the president of Standard Oil, who was there for that historic occasion. And Will said, "Now, I'm about to talk to millions of people for the first time in history. Caesar couldn't do it, Alexander couldn't do it, but I'm about to do it. It better be damned important. What do you think I ought to talk about?" "Well, Will," the president of Standard Oil said, "you should probably remind the people out there that Standard Oil of New Jersey is a service company." Well, he didn't know what that meant. Walked around and thought about it. For a while, they stood him in front of the microphone, threw the switch, and there he was, alive in front of all of America and parts of Mexico and Canada, first time in history. And he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I've been asked to offer a few remarks about Standard Oil of New Jersey, especially as regards their policy of service." Well, I didn't know what that meant, but then I cast my mind back over the long years to my daddy's old ranch in Oklahoma. Remembered we had a big stud bull, and the farmers would bring their cows by for service.
No.
Talking to millions of people, you know. So I said, I didn't know what that was. I said, "Daddy, what is this service we've been offering?" And my daddy said, "You're too young to know about that, son. Nature will provide that information in due course, and by the time you've got it, be so glad you got it, you won't care where it came from." Same stuff they always do to little kids. Well, I'm sort of disappointed. But then my daddy went away on a selling trip. He sold lightning rods part-time for a firm out of Des Moines, Iowa. And the hired hands were out stretching wire. I was up at the big house alone, and a neighbor came by leading a cow asking for service. I thought, well, this might be my opportunity to find out what that might be. I run him into the pen, closed the gate, climbed up on the top rung, and sat down to watch. Well, my neighbor said, "Get down off of there, son. You're too young to know about that right now." And he sent me packing. I was sort of disappointed. But I knew around back of that pen was a high board fence. And in that fence was some knot holes. I snuck around quiet, rolled some cordwood up against the back of the fence, clambered up on it, had my eye to one of them knot holes, and I peered through. And ladies and gentlemen, I saw right there in front of me exactly what it is Standard Oil's been doing to the people all these years. Ask any old timer around old Cheyenne, railroad in Wyoming is the best in the land. A long steel rail and a short cross tie laid out over the Great Divide. Yeah, railroad along the Great Divide. Nothing around me but the Rockies and sky. It's there you find me as years go by, railroading on the Great Divide. Thank you for coming out tonight. I understand it's going to be snowing down in Philadelphia. Is it already? We're in Delaware. It'll chase us over to the western New York State, I suppose. We'll go over and visit some folks in Ithaca.
All right. Great town.
Find out about the Ithaca dollars. Ideas to take back home and put to work, see? Well, yeah, I'm in Nevada City now. I was living in Spokane, Washington. Most of the time that I played through here, like a Godfrey Daniels, I was living in Spokane. When I left Spokane under somewhat of a cloud, I burned out a lot of towns, folks. But I was well settled there and raising a family. My kids are Montessori kids, they were. And they do this state writers project. I don't know if they do that here, but they put poets and writers, novelists in the schools and teach the kids writing skills. And then they have young writers' conferences in the school and then to the district and then all the way up to the state level. Well, my son was part of that program when he was in Montessori, and he was a good storyteller when he was a little kid. He would get sent home from school for telling stories. And when you get sent home from Montessori, you have blown it in a major way. That's hard to do. What the hell was it? He said, the one he got sent home for... how come the crack in your butt goes up and down instead of back and forth? So when you're in the playground going down the slide, you don't go Yeah, well, he was in this young writers thing, and they had the big state contest and the state conference, and they invited me to come and tell stories. Now, I had to live there at that time, and so I was going to behave myself. But I got to this enormous room, looked like a dirigible hangar. I think it was a gymnasium. And there were 2,100 young faces out there, none of them which had any prospects anybody could detect. And along the side of the stage there was the, I saw the school, there was the school principals, and there was the people in the school district, and then the main speaker from the Chamber of Commerce who was going to follow me. Something inside of me snapped. And I got to the microphone and said something to the effect of, you're about to be told one more time that you're America's most valuable natural resource. Have you seen what they do to valuable natural resources? Have you seen a strip mine? Have you seen a clear cut in the forest? Have you seen a polluted river? Don't ever let them call you a valuable natural resource. They're going to strip mine your best thoughts. They're going to clear cut your soul, your spirit, for the sake of profit, unless you learn to resist, because the profit system follows the path of least resistance, and following the path of least resistance is what makes a river crooked. Ha! Well, it was great gnashing of teeth and rending of garments. Mine. And I was borne to the door screaming epithets over my shoulders, something to the effect of, make a break for it, kids! Flee to the wilderness! One within, if you can find it. Well, I left the state. Ha-ha. Moved to Nevada City. I've been there, 15 years now. I wrote those kids a nice letter for their little literary magazine. I respect little kids. I gave them a lot of sage advice, too. Advice got from my mother to help me down the road of life. She'd say things like, a bird in the hand ain't worth nothing if you're trying to blow your nose. She was right. Can't. Doesn't work. But the truth of the truth what I wrote those kids was that if you learn anything in your barn of learning, let it be this, that being likable will get you further than talent. Do I know this? Well, I sang this song here at that dismal occasion, and they didn't like it any better than the sermon. Let's see if I remember it. A song for the liberation of children.
Oh, look what I found out here in the backyard. It's fuzzy and crawls like it's going somewhere. When I open my hand up and ask you my question, you thump me and holler, don't bring it in here. I had me a thought that I wanted to tell you. I had an idea I wanted to share. But you make me feel like I don't know nothing, and sometimes I wonder if you even care. Oh, I'm stuck down here in a world full of giants. You push me around like a dumb little kid. And sometimes you hit me just because you want to. I don't even know what it is that I did. Oh, mommy's out getting her hair up in curlers. Daddy's wrapped up in his football and beer. And maybe they think that I'm just a damn nuisance, but I sure as hell didn't ask to be here. Oh, I ain't a broom you can hide in a closet. I ain't a dog you can bribe with a treat. I'm tired of your threats and your punches and promises, and I'd run away, but I can't cross the street. Surrounded by teachers and preachers and parents, you say everybody knows better than me. But I know some things that you never thought of, and you'd be surprised at the stuff that I see. Well, I see the ants and I see the butterflies. I see the birds and the tops of the trees. I got me a camera that doesn't miss nothing, and my friends are anything smaller than me. I've tried all I can to get your attention. I'll have to try something else, I suppose. When you tiptoe in to tuck in my covers, I think I'll sit up and bite off your nose. Now everyone's trying to get liberated. You all got the notion you want to be free. Red folks and poor folks and black folks and women. Now all you damn grown-ups, quit picking on me.
Kids are grown now. You know, when I was playing back around here, like up at Godfrey's or down in Philadelphia, they hadn't been born. Well, my older boy had, Duncan. He's 41 now. But then my daughter is working for the state assembly in Washington State. God, I didn't do that. And Brendan is a nascent rock and roll star. He's 25. And then I have one grandchild who's 3 years younger than my daughter. It's a peculiar situation. It is. When the kids were little, they grew up on stories. They loved stories. They understood the power of stories, and they still do. Bedtime. They really liked the cowboy stories because that it faded out of television, and there weren't any movies. And it was all mythology anyway. They liked the cowboy stories. Their favorite story? Well, let's see. Yeah. Colonel Charlie Goodnight and Oliver Loving, pioneers, settlers of the old Southwest, and folk heroes, both of them. Founders of the great Goodnight Loving Trail, the westernmost of the great cattle trails, from El Paso, Texas, to Denver, with a long spur into Montana. Now, if I'm not mistaken, in years past, I have come through your territory and talked about the egg-setting horse, the great turtle drive of 86, and if you missed that, well, it was a rare beauty. Story about their middle years. Colonel Goodnight was about 55 years old. Oliver Lovin in his mid-40s. They were quartered in Taos, New Mexico at the time. Now, Colonel Goodnight was a rancher, a wealthy man. He built a beautiful house in town. Oliver Loving was a wrangler, you know what I mean? He handled the remuda, the horses that traveled with any herd on a trail drive. So he had to corral the horses on the outside of town, built himself a little cabin, an outhouse. A little one-hole outhouse, put a new hickory seat in there, two coats of spar varnish. He wanted it to weather, it would last a long time. Well, he finished painting it, and then he went into town to visit, but not anticipating visitors, he neglected to put a wet paint sign on the door, and he went off into town. Well, Colonel Goodnight loped up, and I mean Colonel Goodnight, a man of vast and consummate dignity, silvered of mane and furrowed of brow, an eagle of eye, hawk of beak, thin of lip, lantern of jaw, ramrod of spine, firm of grip, swivel of hip, lean of shank, fleet of foot, the whole nine yards. He was a picture of the old West, cast about for Oliver Lovin, couldn't find him, spied the new outhouse, decided he'd run some field trials on it. He always loved the quality of the literature in Oliver's outhouse. He'd say, read it and wipe, that's what he'd say. Well, he went in there and he sat down. He was there for the better part of 4 hours, lodged fast, see? Couldn't get up. By the time Oliver come back, he was down there bellering, mattering a boiled owl. Pretty mad, you got to admit.
Well, don't worry about it, Charlie Oliver, you could call him that. Oliver said, and he hot-footed it up to the house, and he got some cold chisels and a rubber-headed mallet hammer, a crowbar, and some spatulas, and a sledgehammer in case the exigency got dire. And went down there, started poking and prodding around the colonel, him bellowing, couldn't budge him. Finally decided to seek some professional advice. With the sledgehammer, he bashed off the front of the outhouse, and with the crowbar, he levered the seat up, but the colonel poked through it, got the whole thing up over one shoulder like a big L, and lugged it outside and hove it, that poop-perfect passive subjunctive of the verb to heave, hove it, I say, up onto the colonel's horse, and led the whole affair down through town, greeting his neighbors, hi Frank, hi Ed, hi Al, well, up to the doc's office. Well, the doc come out and walked all the way around the horse 3 or 4 times, and Oliver said, well, doc, you ever see anything like that? Doc said, why, yes, I have, but not with a frame around it. Well, the kids grew up with a lot of things they could tell, you know, do for show and tell. Get them in a lot of trouble, too. Then I sing them this song here. Now, I made this song, but I made it for an old rancher out in Troy, Montana, by the name of Ralph Mons Sr. He was the first one to ever talk to me about Colonel Goodnight and Oliver Loving and the Goodnight Loving Trail. And I made this for him for his 86th birthday. It's not a cowboy song. It's a song about getting old and having your work run out on you, the work that you were born to do. A lot of these old cowboys, the way Ralph told me, was down in the southwest, to the head end of that trail. Well, they get too busted up inside to sit a horse properly. And so they would get set off on the chuck gang, have to handle the bedrolls, doctor the old chilblains and saddle sores with the Indian cures. Most of all, they would get left behind at the fire when everybody rode into town to hoorah. And then have to have the coffee boiled up to sober them up for another day's work. A rude letdown for anybody who had led a rough and a vigorous life. He said down in the southwest, those camp cooks, they were called the old woman because they had the foolish notion that only women do cooking. Hey, Ralph. Everything. If dirt was a kingdom, then you'd be the king on the Goodnight Trail, on the Loving Trail. Our old woman's lonesome tonight. If French Harp blows like a lone ball and calf, it's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin and get in there and blow out the light. With your snake oil and herbs and your liniment too, you can do anything that a doctor can do, except find a cure for your own goddamn stew on the Goodnight Trail, on the Loving Trail. Our old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French harp blows like a lone bawling calf. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin and get in there and blow out the light. The cook fire's out and the coffee's all gone. The boys are up and they're raising the dawn. You're still sitting there all lost in a song on the Goodnight Trail, on the Loving Trail. Our old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French harp blows like a lone bawling calf. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin and get in there and blow out the light.
Yeah, I know that someday I'll be just the same, wearing an apron instead of a name, and no one can change it and no one's to blame. The desert's a book road in lizards and sage. It's easy to look like an old torn out page, faded and cracked with the colors of age. On the goodnight trail, the loving trail, our old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French harp blows like a lone ball and calf. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin and get in there and blow out the light.
Reflect on it was built, most of what I do was built around old people, older people, seeking out my elders, like old Ralph Kahn Sr. And so many others, old wobbly socialists, communists, hard rock miners, loggers, people I used to hang out with up in the panhandle of North Idaho. And now, dude, that's why one of the reasons I'm in Nevada City, because of the old gold miners, you know, the remnants of those gold camps at the French, you know, Corral and Penville and all those. Well, I and most of my elders, I never thought I'd ever be able to say this. It's a damned odd thing to say. Most of my great teachers were born the century before last. I mean, they're born in the 1890s, thereabouts. And I met them and got to know them, and they became my teachers I am the age that they were then, when I first met them. That's also equally peculiar. I guess the principal elder in my life was a fellow by the name of Ammon Hennessy, and I know some of you heard me talk about him before, a man who saved my life when I got back from Korea, where I was a soldier, and I was on the freight trains pretty steady for a couple of years, drunk most of the time because I was so pissed off at what I'd seen and done. I didn't know if I could live in the country anymore. Now, I fetched up in this house of hospitality, Catholic Worker House, one of Dorothy Day's places called the Joe Hill House in Salt Lake City. And it was a house for transients, migrants, bums, homeless people, the old county dog pound out by the roper yards of the Denver Grand and Western Railroad, because everybody was on the freight train pretty much, the distances being what they are out there. I had come south on a Western Pacific into the roper yards and was going to change there for WP headed for the coast. But I'd heard about this house that had the lantern hanging out so you could find it, that had a barrel full of free clothes and food and warmth. It was cold, it was early spring. But I found it. But most of all, I found this wiry little guy named Ammon Hennessy. I met him in his 70th year. Ammon was a Catholic anarchist pacifist, draft dodger in two world wars, tax refuser, vegetarian, wise guy, one-man revolution in America, which about covers it. He was love in action, using Dostoevsky's words. Love in action is harsh and dreadful compared to love in dreams. And he was hard without being brittle. He was hard without having that brittle hardness a lot of tough men have that would shatter if you struck it too hard. Ammon never went to the polls. You know, he never went to the polls. He was an anarchist. And I kept questioning him on that vigorously. Well, Ammon's body was his ballot. And he cast that body ballot in behalf of the poor, the homeless around him every day of his life. Paid a terrible price for it. And you couldn't tell him he hadn't voted. He said, yeah, I did vote. I just didn't assign responsibility to other people to do things. I accepted responsibility and saw to it that something got done. Huh?
real different way of looking at voting, isn't it? We stood up many times in front of Federal District Judge Ritter, picketing illegally against war taxes down in front of the post office of the federal bust. Ammon never pled innocent or guilty. He pled anarchy. And Ritter would say, "What the hell is that, Hennessy?" You say, "Well, an anarchist is anybody who don't need a cop to tell him what to do. Fundamentalist anarchist." Well, and then of course the judge would say, "But Ammon, you broke the law. What about that?" Ammon would say, "Oh, Judge, your damn laws, the good people don't need them and the bad people don't obey them, so what use are they anyway?" And we took people in. People had been thrown out of the other missions. Well, they were too drunk or spilled their beans. We turned nobody away. And we always sang on Friday night. Ammon would speak to about Eugene V. Debs, Clarence Darrow, people he'd known. And then we'd sing to him, whoever was there. I'll sing you one of those songs made up of a bunch of conversations that I had on the DNRG at W and just, you know, over that time. And I thought of this song when I was reading in the newspaper about your prodigious great snowstorms back here, which were the snows that I miss. I bet you're tired of them, but I miss them out where I am. And the newspaper talked about how the traffic couldn't move and people couldn't get to work and the businesses were closing. And I thought, there isn't a word in here about the people living on the street. Not a word about the people living in the doorways, locked out of the missions, living under the stairs. And that's why I thought of this song here for them. I'm walking through your town in the snow. I'm walking through your town in the snow. I've got no place to go. The trains are running slow. And I'm walking through your town in the snow. It's getting late and all the bars are closed. It's getting late and all the bars are closed. It's so cold I can't think. I could really use a drink. And I'm walking through your town in the snow. Don't these little winter towns all look the same? Don't these little winter towns all look the same? How the prairie breezes blow when the mission doors are closed. And I'm walking through your town in the snow. I carry my home on my back. I carry my home on my back. But the police only frown every time I lay it down. Now I'm walking through your town in the snow. There's some fellas jungled up by the yard. There's some fellas jungled up by the yard. They'll be cooking up down there, but I've nothing left to share. And I'm walking through your town in the snow. Well, maybe I can rustle up a job. Yeah, maybe I can rustle up a job. But there's nothing I can do. My best working years are through. And I'm walking through your town in the snow. Don't think I'll ever find a way back home. I don't think I'll ever find a way back home. I can see my golden years shining through the frozen tears, and I'm walking through your town in the snow. I'm walking through your town in the snow. I'm walking through your town in the snow. I've got no place to go. The trains are running slow, and I'm walking through your town in the snow. I'm walking through your town in the snow. I'll send you a couple more here, and you gotta reach out and help those folks, you know. So, I was in and among them. And,
where he trees a hen. Ammon came to me one day. He said, "You've got to be a pacifist." And I said, "What?" He said, "You got to be a pacifist." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you act out a lot. You brawl a lot." I was really, I carried a lot of anger with me, a whole lot of anger. He said, "You brawl, and you're not any good at it. And you're the one who keeps getting thrown through the door, and I'm tired of fixing the damn thing. You've got to be a pacifist." It's sort of a fundamentalist view of pacifism, I guess, the way of looking at it. I said, "What's that?" "Well," Ammon said, I could give you a book by Gandhi, but you wouldn't read it or understand it. He said, you got to look at your capacity for violence, your violence like booze, you know, like an alcoholic looks at alcohol. Alcohol will kill an alcoholic," he said, "unless he has the courage to sit in a circle of people that are like that and put his hand up and say, 'Hi, my name's Utah, I'm an alcoholic.' But then you can begin to, once you own the behavior, you begin to deal with it, you begin to fight it, you begin to have it defined for you by the people whose lives you've messed with, huh? And it's never going to go away. 20 years sober, you're not going to sit in that circle and say, 'Well, I've been 20 years without a drink, I guess I'm not an alcoholic.' Well, you're going to put up your hand and say, 'Hi, my name's Utah, I'm an alcoholic, huh?' But it'll save your life." He said, "It's the same with your violence. You've got to take on your violence as a social addiction, and you've got to acknowledge it, you've got to learn how to deal with it every minute, every day, in every situation for the rest of your life, because it's not going to go away, huh? But it'll save your life." A different way of looking at pacifism, for sure. I said, "Okay, Ammon, I'll try that." I was ready to lay it down. I was ready to lay down that heavy manhood trip, you know, the one I picked up in Korea, which was a license for excess of every kind, I mean, real excess, and begin to realize that I had the vision of manhood I've been given by my father, my scoutmaster, my gym teacher, my army sergeant, all those people. They were all a lie. They were a blueprint for self-destruction. I was ready to lay it down. I was exhausted. There, Ammon opened the door for that. I said, "Okay, I'll try it." Ammon said, "It's not enough." I said, "Oh." He said, "You were born a white man in mid-20th century industrial America. You came into the world armed at the teeth of an arsenal of weapons, the weapons of privilege, economic privilege, racial privilege, sexual privilege. You want to be a pacifist. You're not just going to give up guns and knives and fists and hard, angry words. You're going to have to lay down the weapons of privilege and go into the world completely disarmed. Try that." Been at it for the past almost 40 years, and I'm still at it. I guess if there's one struggle that animates my reason for being on the planet, that's probably the one. Just something for you to chew on, all right? And, you know, if I want to come this far for this short a time, I better have something I ought to want to get at, don't you think? And that's it. Ammon had a favorite song, Woody Guthrie's last song. Woody wrote it at the beginning of the Korean War. He was on his way to the hospital then, but probably was his last song. I added some new words to it to bring it into our time. I didn't think that Woody would mind. "Why do your warships sail on my waters? Why do your death bombs fall from my skies? Why do you burn my town and my farm down? I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. Why do your ships haul death to my people? Nitro blockbusters, big cannons and guns. Why can't your ships haul some food and some clothing? I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. What good work did you do? I'd like to ask you to give you the money right out of my hand. I built your big house to hide from my people. Why do you hide so? I've got to know. And why can't we spend more to build homeless shelters? Why are the homeless here anyhow?
The fortunes are building on war and on killing. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know now. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. You locked me in jail, you put me in prison. Your hospital's jammed and your crazy house full. Why did your cop hurt my unarmed peace worker? I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. Now my friends are dying from AIDS and from cancer. Your big money goes where the death missiles fly. I'm built by good workers and paid by war taxes. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know.
One together, and then we will send you out to the refreshments. And I have the phonograph records there. It's not what they call them, is it? Well, they're recordings, I guess. There's one that I brought with me. People had asked me a long time, say, did you ever make a recording of just stories? You know, an old song, just stories? Music lovers, probably. And yes, I did do that. And I have the Moscow Hold and other tales. I made one out home called I've Got to Know. Just songs, stories, poems, polemics. I have no rant control about war and peace, you know, that I made myself because I had things I wanted to talk about. So, and then, of course, my friends, fellow workers from the industrial workers of the world are here. Union I belong to now for 44 years, 45 in June. And they have our books and IWW yo-yos, wobbly yo-yos. Just stop by and visit with him there. I'm glad you're here. I'll go to Ithaca, then I'll go back home on Sunday. Got a lot to do. We started a peace center out home in a real conservative rural county in California. Got a peace center going. We've got peace recruiters in the high school. We got Vietnam combat vets in the classroom now talking about the realities of war. We're doing our job, okay. When I get back. And we're doing yours too. When I get back, though, it's time to start the sign up for Little League. I love working the Little League. We've got a beautiful Little League park where the moon comes up and it's fringed by pines and it's a good hot dog stand. Dandy place. But see, the local businesses field the teams, and so their jerseys have the name of the team on it, and to go out on the field, that helps advertise. So I've talked to Peace Center, and we're going to field a Little League team this year. And the kids are going to run on the field, and the name of their team is going to be Reduced Military Spending.
I love it.
We'll see what happens. Here's a song from old Maurice Sugar, the Forward Hunger March, 1932. Depression, that's when the company guard turned the machine guns on the workers who had hit the bricks on the outside. And Maurice Sugar, I learned this song from my mother. My bedtime song, my mother worked for the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, in-plant organizing. And our bedtime songs when we were little were labor songs. And that's hard. When I'm a little kid, okay? And I've had a hard day at kindergarten. And my mother's sitting at the end of the bed, we're going to roll union. I'll say, Christ, my goal. I've got to get some sleep around this place. Well, that's one I learned from her. I'm spending my night in a flop house. I'm spending my days on the street.
I am looking for work, but I find none. I wished I had something to eat. Fairly basic song, don't you think? Oh, soup, soup. They gave me a bowl of soup. Soup, soup. They gave me a bowl of soup.
You think you can handle that chorus there? It's fairly rudimentary. Try it out.
Oh, soup, soup. They gave me a bowl of soup. Soup, soup. They gave me a bowl of soup.
I was playing in Boise, Idaho, doing a job for the ACLU. They put me up in a crumbling Victorian pile that purported to be a hotel. I went out in the morning to get myself a newspaper. While I was walking up the street, and a young fellow stepped out of the doorway and said, "Hey man, you got any spare change? That happened around here? Some? That happens all over." I said, "No. I mean, not that I'm an ungenerous soul. I will fling money about with abandon when I've got it." What I said to him was, "Now, I want you to go away, and I'll stand right here and wait. I want you to get a gunny sack or a pillowcase, put a rock in it, throw it over your shoulder, and then come back and walk up to me and say, 'Excuse me, but I've got a chicken in this sack, and I'm going to go on the edge of town and cook it up, but I don't have any salt. Could you spare some change for some salt?' Get the difference? I'm willing to pay for the story. You know, I'm willing to pay." I said, "Young fella, I want you to gaff me. I want you to gaff me. What is a gaff? Well, how's a fisherman bring in the fish? Well, it's a gaffing hook. What is a fish? That's the mark. How do you gaff the roofs and your pipe and the stem? Is this too abstract for you?" Imagine my plight. I want to, everybody's got a gaff. Everybody, lawyers got a gaff, preachers got a gaff, teachers got a gaff. I've got a gaff. God knows I'm using it right now. I want to grab these fair change artists and rattle them and say, "Where's your sense of drama? Where's your sense of the theater of your situation? All the things that you could do with it." I learned from gaffing artists when I was a kid. I learned from gaffing artists, and it's all around us. It's the best and most beautiful of the American psyche, the most creative. How to get through the world without doing anything. The rich have long since figured out how to do this. Why can't we? God, it is. I remember during the last election, in the Lucky supermarket parking lot, a fellow sitting there with a cardboard sign said, "Willing to vote Republican for food." I was waiting for a light to change. It was in Cambridge. I was driving in Cambridge. And on the Meridian, there was a big, tall fellow dressed in rags. He had this folded cardboard sign. Top of the sign said, "What is the greatest nation on earth?" Got my attention. He let the sign flop down and said, "Donation." That's good for a couple dollars, isn't it? Ironclad. Here's an ironclad one. The best gaff I ever heard. It was fellow worker Divine, a wobbly up there in Butte, Montana. He used to hang with Mark Ross. And she worked at the Copper King down in a cafe down on the flat. Well, they don't pay very well. Nothing pays good in Butte. She wanted to go to a wedding in Florida among her kin. She had maybe enough money for gas for her old car. She started out in the dead of winter over the belly of the continent. Generally at midnight, hopefully in the driving sleet and rain and snow, she would pull into some greasy rundown truck stop. She would go into the restaurant, sit in a dimly lit back booth, reach into her purse and take out a cupcake, put it on the table, reach back into her purse and take out a candle, put it in a cupcake, light it, and softly sing happy birthday to herself. Broke those truckers' hearts. Broke their hearts. She couldn't pay for nothing going or coming. Now that's brilliant. That's genius. This stuff should be in the scout manuals. Where was I?
Oh, I worked 20 years in a factory. I did everything I was told. They said I was loyal and faithful. But now I am out in the cold. Oh, soup, soup. They gave me a bowl of soup. Soup, soup. They gave me a bowl of soup.
Well, then there was Slow Motion Shorty. Now, he was an older gaffer. He's the kind of guy I would learn from, one of my elders.
We would ride the DNR G&W over Soldier Summit up through Moscow down into Denver on the freights. He was an old guy. Slow motion Shorty's gaff was that he had a pocket full of these long skinny balloons that you make balloon animals out of. He had, you know, at that time, a nickel's worth. We would go to a supermarket parking lot. He would wait for a couple to come out with a little kid in tow between them. He would then kneel down in front of them, arresting their course, whip out the balloons, stretch them out, blow them up, wrench them together into the semblance of a small puppy. He wasn't any good at it. And the kid would reach for it and say, "This puppy costs a dollar. Go ask your old man for a dollar." Well, the kid's over tugging on the old man's pants, you know, whimpering, and while he's over there, Shorty takes out his pocket knife, opens the blade, puts it up against the balloon. He says, "You wouldn't want me to kill the little puppy in front of the kid, would you?" Got through town. Oh, I saved $15 with my banker to buy me a car and a yacht. I went down to draw out my fortune. Hey, this is the answer I got. You guessed it. Oh, soup, soup. They gave me a bowl of soup. Soup, soup. They gave me a bowl of soup. Oh, one more, just one more. Dog and Bill. I don't want to leave out, but Dog and Bill, the world's slowest human. They go through, he got his moniker, Dog and. His summer camp was behind the Speedway Diner outside Forsyth, Montana. I don't know if it's still there or not. He's not. I don't know if the diner's still there or not. But he was the laziest, slowest man on earth. He had this big Montana bedroll, and skillfully embroidered on the side in Latin were the words, "Mors antes servitium," death before employment. He was so slow. One time he said to me, he was slow. He said, "I was born with a finite amount of hurrying power. If I squander it fruitlessly racing about, and a dire event transpires, I will have exhausted my hurrying power, and I won't be able to get out of the way in time, and I will be done for. But if I hoard my hurrying power, and that event transpires, I will unleash it all at once, and you will see me move like a rocket." The most exhaustive excuse for being lazy I ever heard. Excuse me, fine. I saw Dog and Bill make $30 an hour on the streets of Spokane over on East Main. He liked to fall in step with a couple. He worked couples. In the evening, out for a stroll, he'd fall walk with them up the street. He'd say something like, "Well, I used to be a magician. Now it's good, sleight of hand, ledger de main. I could do all of that, but too many late hours, too much booze, my hands started to go bad. Nobody wants a magician anymore anyway. I used to be able to take a dollar bill and roll it up tight, push it up one side of my nose and pull it out the other. A cheap trick." Well, 3 out of 5 people went for it. He'd take the dollar bill and roll it up and jam it into his nose, say, "Well, I guess I forgot how to do it," and try to hand it back. You can do that tonight, right out here in front of the Washington Inn. "When I die and I get up to heaven, St. Peter will let me ride in. He can tell by the soup I was fed on, I was unable to sin. Oh, soup, soup, they gave me a bowl of soup. Soup, soup, they gave me a bowl of soup." Please welcome back to the stage, Utah Phillips. Yay. Well, are you all taken care of there?
Yep.
I love hanging out. I love hanging out with you. It's a way of life, isn't it? We're an extraordinary thing. This is the old barn, huh? Walter Baum's barn. Yeah, it is. Yeah, Walter Baum, he built the barn, built the livery stable here, and that's what this was
now transformed into this theater. And it hadn't been torn down. I had dinner over there at the Washington Tavern over there. That's quite a magnificent building, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We had a place like that in Nevada City. Old place, it was, but it was torn down to make room for an old Indian burial ground. let's see, where does the human mind go to now? Now, I was talking about radio to some folks out there about KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. It's one of my favorite community radio stations. I do most of my work with community radio. A lot of what I hear on the radio I find enormously disturbing. You know, if I take my information, if I take what's going on in the world from the top down, you know, from major media, I don't have a television set. I haven't had one for 27 years. I can't stand the damn things. But if I take, I can get real depressed. You know, the world's going to hell in a wheelbarrow. But if I cruise the streets, if I walk at the bottom, if I see what people are doing at the bottom, you know, there's too many good people doing too many good things for me to afford the luxury of being pessimistic. You know, it's like Desmond Tutu said, I'm a prisoner of optimism. And I would just rather be that way. No thanks to the news, damn it. I used to get up in the morning, may I dwell on this a moment? I used to get up in the morning and make my tea and turn on the radio, turn on NPR, a boring sedition, a few things mumbled, whatever it is. And, and I would listen to the news, and of course it had, I'm starting my day, and they would give me a catalog of all the horrors that had transpired the previous 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And it already happened, it was a fait accompli, and I couldn't change it. All I could do was feel remorse or anger or pity, all these emotions that I had no place to put as they sailed into my day. And finally I said, why do I want to do this to myself? See, why do I want to do this to myself? God, I get worked up about this. I know that the country has been taken over by assholes. I know it. I mean, pardon my language, you know, most obscenities are racist or sexist or denigrate somebody's religion, huh? And I don't want to do that. So we are left with the generic asshole. One size fits all. I know it's been taken over by assholes. I mean, I don't have to be told again and again. I've opened Nation magazine. Oh, look what the assholes did this month. I already know they're assholes. I don't have to be told, for Christ's sake. Now, in the morning, I turn on the radio to see if we're at war. And if we are, I get ready to go to jail. And if we're not, I turn off the radio and go into the world and try to do something useful. Feel a lot better about it. Well, here's a song I made up about that. Kind of about, I don't know what this song's about. I switched on the radio, turned the dial, thought I'd listen to some news for a while. Grabbed the knob and spun it around, got NPR, here's what I found. Real news, hardly a trace, just one damn marathon marketplace. Dow's up, Nasdaq's in the cellar, and NPR sold out to Rockefeller.
Ooh.
Hostile takeover, real hostile. Well, I hear all about the antitrust and all the day traders who bit the dust. Mergers, buyouts, and acquisitions, low-down crooks in high positions. Wheelers, dealers, and CEOs fired and paid off through the nose. Buying yachts and fancy homes like they did with the money from the savings and loans. And I get pissed. Off, that is. Well, it's dot-com this and dot-com that, and the underwriters are a-getting fat on airwaves stole from you and me by a bunch of thieves called the FCC. And they don't give a damn what we want or need. They've all caved into corporate greed and sold us out to the ruling class. Wow, the whole damn bunch can dot my com. Got tired of being treated like a veg, so I called up the station and canceled my pledge. And in a final act of liberation, sent the money off to my community station. I said, I love you, but if you blow it, I'll sure as hell let you know it. I'll knock the radio off the shelf, buy a transmitter, and do it myself. Whitebeard the pirate. This is radio station HOBO, broadcasting on a vagrancy of 60 to 90 days. Signing off for now. Close to the ground as I could possibly get, and watch and talk to people, see what they're up to, see what they're doing. Like I say, I'm going to go over to Ithaca and find out about Ithaca dollars and that whole alternative health plan that they've got going over there. Ideas that I can pick up from different parts of the country and take back to where I live and try to put to work. It's wonderful. And a couple of old people that I've kept track of for years that I'm going to visit to get over there, too. I think about those old ones a lot. I was thinking about old Phil Melman, San Francisco Phil Melman. I was in Chicago and visiting Fred Thompson, who was the General Secretary Treasurer of the Union once, and editor of our newspaper for many years. I knew Fred when he was alive. Fred had done time for our union in the 1920s, you know, criminal syndicalism bust, 5 years in San Quentin Federal Penitentiary as a political prisoner. Fred was a powerful, powerful intellect. Fred said, you know, we got a lot of young people joining the IWW, and we used to organize on the street. We had soapboxers, and we got to mobilize some of our old-timers that could soapbox and teach our young ones how to do that. He said, now the best soapboxer we had was Phil Melman. That was his cellmate out there in Quentin, was Phil Melman. He said, and I know Phil Melman is still alive out there somewhere because he was too mean to die. So I know he's there. Now you're traveling in California, you try to find him. Well, I was out in California and I've heard persistent rumors around the Bay Area of a San Francisco Phil Melman. And we did find him, finally, down on the Mission, on the skids, little bare wire bulb flat, neat as a pin. And there was San Francisco Phil Melman. Cranky, cranky old shit he was. Unpleasant, but heart of gold. When we found Phil Melman, he swore that he was the last living Wobbly. That's how far away he was. That everybody was dead or in jail or had sold out. Given that he thought he was the last living Wobbly, every May Day, which is the real Labor Day, if you got any sense, every May Day, Phil Melman would take a soapbox, hobble down to the N. Judah subway, or the trolley car, take it up, change trains, make his way up to San Francisco State University, go out onto the diagonal there, and set that soapbox up and get up on it and start windmilling, he called it, street speaking. And of course, the kids would flow by sporting their books like young asses, the way Lamontagne said, and they wouldn't pay any attention to him. Well, I had a car, you know, in California, and some May Days there, I would make sure that I was in California, in San Francisco, to pick him up on May Day, him and his box. And I would drive up there, we'd go out on the diet, of course I had my guitar, so we could do it old style, where I would pound out Joe Hill songs, Power in the Union, and The Preacher and the Slave, and shill up a crowd. Get a big donut, maybe 200 students gathered around to see what the ruckus was. When I got them all assembled, I put up the soapbox and say, okay, Melman, go get them. Well, by this time, he was really backed up like old plumbing. I mean, there was a lot in him that had been on hold for years and years and hadn't been able to say it to anybody, so it all came out at once. It was like a machine gun, gotta hear it. Fellow workers, the industrial workers of the world, organize the entire working class. What is the working class, fellow workers? Why, the working class is anybody got a boss and works for wages. You got a boss, you're working for wages. It doesn't matter if you're a college professor or a dish digger. If you're working for wages and got a boss, you're in the working class and better be proud of it. While the middle class is just a joke made up by the boss to keep us fighting against each other. Now, the industrial workers of the world, organize the working class into one big union of all skilled, some skilled, unskilled workers into one big union, the OBU. We got the OBU out of a general strike. Strike like that'll last about half an hour. Then we'll take this thing apart and put it together so it makes more sense. With a means of production on the hands of producers, produce for use instead of profit, create abundance for workers and nothing for parasites. Thank you. There's a whole book there. If you slow that down and analyze it, there's a whole book there. It's
solid truth. Last time I saw Millman alive, well, I was playing a place called the Plowshares in San Francisco. The fellow workers in the Bay Area carried Millman up three flights of concrete steps in a chair because his legs were too weak and he couldn't make it up. One of them came backstage and said, "Hey, Melman's out front." I went out and I knelt down by his chair and said, "Hi, Millman, it's Utah." He said, I said, "Remember San Francisco State, I'd sing and then you'd soapbox." Well, he cocked his head open one eye and said, "Oh, yeah, you were lousy." Yes. Well, it was some time later up in Seattle there. And what the District Labor Council was doing, memorializing the Everett Massacre, one of those ones that didn't make it into the history books. So 1916, a shingle weaver strike up on Puget Sound above Seattle. And the IWW, the Wobblies, had rented a steam launch called the Verona. And they steamed up there to bring strike relief to Everett. And it's also a free speech fight. Well, Sheriff McRae and Everett had ringed the dock with every drunk in town whom he deputized and given a rifle to. And the Verona docked. They dropped the gangplank, and Sheriff McRae stood at the bottom of the gangplank and said, "Who are your leaders here?" And with one voice, they shouted back, "We are all leaders here." Well, then the shooting started, and the Wobblies weren't armed, but the deck was raked with gunfire. All those Wobblies were killed. They finally backed the boat out and did escape, but that was what we were doing on this rented boat was memorializing that. It was about 15 years ago. Well, there were a bunch of young Wobblies on that boat, and one of them had Melman's ashes in a cigar box. I didn't know he died. So I took the young ones out on the fantail away from the trade unionists, and I got them in a circle, and I told them Melman stories, Melman, Emma Goldman, and they hadn't known him. And every one of those young ones put their hand in that box of ashes and grabbed a handful and strewed it out onto Puget Sound. Got my hand on the box, said, "I've got you, Melman. Wowsy, huh?" Melman, well, here's a song Melman knew on the skids up in Seattle years ago about taking the lumber barges up Lake Chelan into the logging camps of the high peaks of the Cascades. "It's up the ramp to the lumber camp with the sick and aching head. I've blowed another winter's stake and I got the gyms instead. It seems I'll never learn the truth that's written plain as day. The more they try to welcome you, the more they make it pay. With blanket stiff and jungle hound and pitch him out the door. Howdy Jack, old timer, when you got the price for more. Oh, the boat is getting rocky and I ain't got a bunk. Not a rare, a cheering liquor, just a turkey full of junk. And it's all of my possessions is what I can carry round. I blowed the rest on the skid roads of 100 Gippo towns. It's lumberjack and timber beast, and give these bums a ride. Have one on the house, old boy, when you're stepping with the tide. Oh, the chokers will be heavy, just as cold, when the hooker gives the highball and we start to dig for gold. And I'll curse the skid road up and down with this rotten drunken tune. But then, of course, I'll up and make another trip next June. Hit blanket stiff and jungle hound and pitch him out the door. Howdy Jack, old timer, when you got the price for more." Well, let's see, now where will my mind wander to? I need to divest myself. Oral flatulence. Well, I was in Mount Olive, Illinois, and I was invited to sing at a memorial in the cemetery there. Now, some of you know who's buried in Mount Olive Cemetery in Illinois, a person of great note in American history. You tell me the name.
Mary Harris Jones.
Mary Harris Jones, good for you. Mother Jones. Mother Jones. It is hard for the human mind to embrace a life that went from the presidencies of Andrew Jackson to the presidency of Woodrow, of Herbert Hoover. She lived 100 years. There were people alive
But when she was a little girl that remembered the Revolutionary War, and she died on the eve of the New Deal. Knew everybody. Your best friend was Powderly, the founder of the Knights of Labor. She knew Sam Gompers, didn't like him, the craft unionists. And it's organized bodies of workers fighting against each other. But mainly she was the miner's mother. She would have, when the miners were organizing underground, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, while they were organizing underground, she had already organized their wives and, armed only with mops and brooms, led them over the snow-covered game trails down into the hollers to drive the scabs out of the coal pits. In Philadelphia once, she was on a speaking trip, and she was touring through a mill. And one by one, the little kids were brought up to her, the child workers in the mill, with parts of their hands missing, or their scalp torn off because they got the hair caught in the looms. And she went to the north, stormed down to the newspaper, the Inquirer, and said, this is shameful, we have to expose this. And the editor said, we can't, because the people who own the mill also own the newspaper. Doesn't change much, does it? What did Mother Jones do? Did she go to Congress? Did she get up a letter writing campaign? No. She organized over 100 of those kids with their parents as chaperones, and they marched 100 miles overland, took the ferry to Staten Island, and camped on President Theodore Roosevelt's front lawn to embarrass him into coming out in favor of child labor laws. Direct action gets the goods. It's a fact. One time, yeah, think about it. It was out in Colorado now. That was the Ludlow strike. The miners were out. Now, see, Mother Jones wasn't an organizer. She was an agitator. But she's a wild card in everybody's deck, and nobody knew how she was going to deal herself. So sometimes the organizers hated her as much as the bosses did. Well, there she was in the Union Hall there at Ludlow. The governor of Colorado had promised not to send in the militia during the strike, but he lied, and he did. And when the word reached the Union Hall that the militia had entered the coal fields, Mother Jones jumped up and said, let's go get them. And she stormed out. Didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She went up there and confronted the militia alone. And that was the year that President Theodore Roosevelt called Mother Jones the most dangerous woman in America. And she was 83 years old. Some kind of dangerous, huh? The song that came out of that, about 1926, a district labor council in West Virginia, only in heavens, I think. Oh, the patriotic troopers come a-marching down the pike, prepared to shoot the miners in the Colorado strike. With whiskey in their bellies and vengeance in their souls, they came prepared to shoot the miners full of holes. In front of those brave troopers loomed, she was less than 5 feet tall, weighed less than 100 pounds. You don't look like that loom, you probably ought to be somebody. In front of those brave troopers loomed a sight you seldom see, a white-haired rebel woman whose age was 83. Charge, cried the valiant captain in awful thunderous tones, and the patriotic troopers charged and captured Mother Jones. Oh, it's great to be a trooper with a musket in your hand, prepared to do the dirty work the lords of wealth command. It's great to shoot a miner and hear his dying groans, but there never was such glory as that charge on Mother Jones. You have patience for more of this stuff?
Yeah.
Let's see what I want to do there. Yeah, I'll do that. Well, now let's go back to Chicago. I was there, a fair time ago, 1970s, mid to late 70s. I was invited to play at the Quiet Night over on Belmont Street. It's a nightclub. Imagine me at a nightclub. And Stan Kenton had played there the week before. I was nervous. I was terrified. Well, I went down about 3 o'clock in the afternoon to look at the place. I climbed the stairs. It was upstairs, big place. Got past the guard dogs. And I went into the big hall. Only the nightlight was on. And there was an old man sitting on the stage at the piano, grand piano. And he didn't see me standing off in the shadows. And he was playing the piano, playing the Moonlight Sonata, beautifully, so restful. And then I looked closely and saw he was only playing with one hand. The other hand was off a stump, off to about here.
He began to pound the piano, this great shock of white hair standing back on his head and his face deeply incised lines. A stocky, powerfully built old man. And in pounding the piano in a rumbling baritone voice, started singing Freiheit, Freedom, the song of the Teilman Brigade during the Spanish Civil War. And he sang Los Cuatro Generales to Wycliffe of Gandesa, the powerful music of the struggle to save the Republic of Spain. If we had come to the aid of the Republic of Spain, there might not have been a Second World War. If you want to understand what's going on in the world now, how it all played out, go back and read about the Spanish Civil War, all right? That's just a good tip. You'll learn a lot. Of course, a lot of Americans went over there in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Well, from all over the world, Mackenzie Papineau Brigade from Canada, all over the world, they came to Spain to save the Republic against the fascists, Franco and the fascists, and of course the Nazi war machine was bombing Guernica, and Mussolini had troops in there, thousands of them, and the Republic failed. The guy at the piano was Eddie Belchowski. He was in the Lincoln Brigade. Crossing the Ebro River, he got his arm blown off. They put him in the field hospital on morphine. Stayed on morphine, killed a drug addict for the next 30 years of his life. Haunted the alleys of Chicago, mad poet. I followed him, used to follow him through those alleys, him drunk as a lord. He wrote poetry on big sketch pads where he drew things of a newsprint. And he'd throw it over his shoulders and I'd catch him. You know, I got a stack of those things that I'd pick up as he left a trail through the alleys at 4 o'clock in the morning. Began to put himself back together, got the job at the Quiet Night as a janitor. Well, he'd have a grand piano to practice at. He got it back. In one hand, he could play the Bach Chaconne, all of Haydn's left-hand variations. See, he had been a concert pianist. He was trained as a concert pianist when he was young. And then, of course, he lost his arm, and that was over for him. He became a great teacher to me. Powerful, powerful lessons. He taught me about holding on and holding on and holding on and never giving up. Well, I left Chicago, was over to Rockford, and I got a call from Ron Stevens, who ran that club, the manager, and he told me that Ed Belchowski had died. So I sat down and made up a death song for Eddie. And a week later, I got a call from Eddie. First thing I asked him was, "Hey Ed, where are you calling from?" Said he was calling from Chicago. I said, "Hell, dead or in Chicago, it's all the same to me, fella." But then a week after that, I was back at the Quiet Night, sitting on a bar stool, and Eddie sitting across from me. I had a chance to sing him his death song. He was amused. Well, it was not too long ago, Ed Belchowski was found under a subway tread on the L in Chicago, so I can sing for him now. Standing in your shadow, afraid to go outside, I could listen to your music all night long. But the world keeps on changing, there's still no place to hide. I guess that we can change it with a song. One hand on the keyboard and moonlight fills the room. One hand on the Ebro, no regrets. One hand on tomorrow, reaching for the sun. One hand on the sun that never sets. The white cliffs of Gandesa lie sleeping in the rain. I guess some places always have their kings. And now I hear you singing the forgotten songs of Spain. I wish we could remember all those things. One hand on the keyboard and moonlight fills the room. One hand on the Ebro, no regrets. And one hand on tomorrow, reaching for the sun. One hand on the sun that never sets. Oh, I thought that I had trouble when I was on the loose. Oh, that must have been a carnival instead. And now I hear our children, they're singing, what's the use? Well, they drop a little something for their head.
by one hand on the keyboard, and moonlight fills the room. One hand on the A-Bro, no regrets. And one hand on tomorrow, reaching for the sun. One hand on the sun that never sets. One hand on the sun that never sets.
I'll send you a couple, just two more here, and then before I'll start spraying you with tiny pieces of esophagus. A grisly prospect at best. Yeah, I love singing the songs about those people. I guess it's one of the things that prods me into traveling. You know, they're all gone. Sooner or later in your life, you've got to decide what you authentically inherit. See? And then that's what you put in the world. That's exactly what I'm doing, you know. That's my inheritance, is their words, their stories, the substance of their lives. And they're gone and I'm here, so, you know, I love sharing that with y'all. It was old Claire Spark down in Southern California many years ago said, the law of memory is the most radical idea in America. Think about that. Yeah, let that settle in. The long memory is the most radical idea in America. Where did that long memory go? You stop somebody on the street, ask them what happened week before last, they can't tell you. We're locked into this week crisis. In that history can work. Let me see. Let me give you an idea of how that can work. I got people in Nevada City where I live, young families that want to move to Canada because of the clampdown on civil liberties and the gradual erosion of American life, you know, and are terrified with all the mega news that they read and get off of the internet. People scared. And I sit down quietly with people. I say, look, when I talk to Fred Thompson about the First World War, old Tom Scribner, and they talk about the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act and all that's the beatings, the jailings, 5,000 members of our union in jail, the mass deportations without any due process, the Palmer raids. It was much, much worse than anything we're experiencing now. And we came out of it. We came out of it with a stronger labor movement. You come up into the Great Depression, the 1930s, and when the Ford goons turned the machine guns on the workers at the Ford plant in 1932. Terrible time, the birth of the CIO, starvation haunted the streets. We came out of that with Social Security, workman's compensation, the minimum wage, huh? Going through the war and then into the McCarthy times, trying to destroy the whole labor movement, you know, right, with Paul Robeson losing his passport. We came out of that, we transcended that, and came out with a civil rights movement that worked, and with a peace movement that was the strongest the nation had ever seen. So when you just look back at that long memory, you see, we're going to do it. We're going to come out on top of this. We're going to come out better. Just take my word for it, okay? I'm a prisoner of optimism. I was singing a song about one of them in the old world. I made it up for an old fella in Spokane, Washington. Used to sit in the Clem Hotel. He's one of those old ones that used to come to town looking for work, a boomer. Working the log and working the mining, working the wheat harvest, got too old to do the work. Fetched up on the skids, on short money, probably alcoholic. And sat in the window of the Clem Hotel, staring out into the parking lot, face ashen gray like death. He wouldn't answer his door because he was afraid of the young jackrollers that would knock you down for your food stamps or your little bit of rocking chair check. I got in so he'd just wave a little bit as I was walking through the parking lot. And I made this song for him. I spent my whole life making somebody rich. I busted my ass for that son of a bitch. And he left me to die like a dog in a ditch. And he told me I'm all used up. He used up my labor, he used up my time. He plundered my body and squandered my mind. And gave me a pension of handouts and wine. And told me I'm all used up. My kids are in hock to a gotcha call work, slaving their lives out for some of the jerk. Yeah, my youngest in Frisco just made shipping clerk. He don't know I'm all used up. Hey, young people reaching for power and gold,
don't have respect for anything old. For pennies they're bought and for promises sold. Someday they'll all be used up. They use up the oil, they use up the trees, they use up the air and they use up the sea. Well, how about you, Brendan? How about me? What's left when we're all used up? I'll finish my life in this crummy hotel. It's lousy with bugs and my God, what a smell. But my plumbing still works and I'm clear as a bell. Don't tell me I'm all used up. Outside my window the world passes by, gives me a handout and spits in my eye. And no one can tell me, cause no one knows why. I'm living but I'm all used up. Sometimes in my dreams I sit by a tree. My life is a book of how things used to be. And kids gather around and they listen to me. And they don't think I'm all used up. And there's songs and there's laughter and things I can do. And all that I've learned I can give back to you. And I'd give my last breath just to make it come true. No, I'm not all used up. They use up the oil and they use up the trees. They use up the air and they use up the sea. Well, how about you, friend, and how about me? What's left when we're all used up?
Well, thank you. Well, no, I'm going to go get a decent night's sleep. And maybe I'll let myself have one beer. Don't tell my wife or my cardiologist or my GP or any of them. I can do that. It's vice. It's called vice. Little simple things like a piece of bacon become stone vice. Tastes good that way. Well, let's sing one together here. This is your new national anthem. I don't wait for committees to arrive at these conclusions. I do these things unilaterally and give folks a chance to catch up. And I do love the pleasure of your company. It's been delightful spending this time with you. Oh, why don't you work like other folks do? How can I get a job when you're holding down two? Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. That's the chorus here. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Do me the pleasure of singing this, will you? Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. I went to a house and knocked on the door. The lady said, "Scram, bum, you've been here before." Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. One of my tasks, one of my tasks as a parent has been to introduce my children to their radical elders. One of the reasons for being in Spokane, like I said, I woke up my daughter when she was little. I wanted to take her over to meet Idaho Blackie over in the Panhandle. I mentioned him earlier. Old Wobbly wrote for the One Big Union Monthly in the 1930s. I'm an organizer. Like I said, I cut my wood at his woodlot because he was too old to work in the forest anymore. I wanted her to meet him, and he had breakfast every morning at a little cafe in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, the 4th Street Cafe. So I woke her up early, because it's 27 miles over there. She missed her oatmeal. She had had oatmeal every morning of her life, all for a long time. That hard ball of carbohydrates down in your middle that radiates heat and energy for 12 solid hours. Eat your gruel, damn it, it's good for you. Well, we drove over there. And there was Blackie at the 4th Street Cafe reading the newspaper. We got there late, so breakfast was off. And the last bowl of oatmeal was sitting there steaming in front of Idaho Blackie. Well, he wouldn't touch it. I offered that man a $5 bill so my daughter could have her oatmeal. He wouldn't acknowledge my presence. My daughter is not to be dealt with in no cavalier fashion like that, no sir. She is aggressive in all the good ways. She would pull a chair up to the other side of the table and picked up a spoon and began to reach under. He's sitting in the paper, reach under that newspaper and skim that oatmeal off, gobble it down. He wouldn't pay any attention to her. Finally, she reached under the paper, grabbed the placemat by the corners, and deftly eased that oatmeal out in front of her and began to toss it down. Got down toward the bottom, and there was a big old cockroach. And it revolted her. She just threw everything back up on the bowl, and Blackie put down the paper and said, "You saw it too." Oh, I like my boss, he's a good friend of mine. Glad was starving out on the bread line. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a hand out to revive us again. Whenever I get all the money I earn, boss will be broke and to work he must turn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a hand out to revive us again. Went over to visit Blackie. His little holding, little cabin was up there in Hayden Lake, Idaho. Unfortunately, his holding was backed up against the compound of the Church of Aryan Nations. Those neo-Nazis that moved in up there, they're thankfully gone now. You know, they're driven out. But at that time, it was a dangerous proposition. I went over to see if Blackie was still alive. Well, there he was, out duck hunting from the front porch. Like I say, too old to go into the forest, but when he was young, he'd go into the forest with a case of whiskey and a shotgun, get so high if you go duck hunting with a rake. Well, there he was blazing away, and he got the duck, but it fell into the compound of the Church of Aryan Nations. Well, Blackie got up slow-like. He was in advanced stages of crusty old farthood. And he worked his way around their fence toward their church. These neo-Nazis pretend to be Christians, but then most Christians do. And there was their school. They had grades 1-8, and there were the little fascist kids out there playing with their Klaus Barbie dolls. Somebody has to think of these things. Well, out of the back, he went to get the duck, and out of the back of that church flew Reverend Butler, the co-founder of that benighted denomination, and there he was in all of his Prussian majesty with his jack boots and his suntans and Sam Brown belt and armband, little 30 mission crush cap with a patent leather bill on it, and he laid hold of that duck in a loud howl as whatever the Lord chose to deliver up on that plot of ground belonged to the Church of Aryan Nations. Well, they altercated some. It was fun to watch. Got to be rancorous, though. And finally, Reverend Butler drew himself up in all of the aforesaid Prussian majesty and announced that we're going to settle this in the manner of true Aryan gentlemen. He said, "We are going to take turns kicking each other in our magic parts." Each other's magic parts, you catch my drift. And the one left standing is going to keep this duck. And you, sir, as it was your shot that felled the bird, will have first crack at it. Well, Blackie tottered back 3 or 4 feet, reached down into some private recess of his soul for energy hoarded for just this occasion. Flew forward, delivered a right smart kick to Reverend Butler's magic parts, cast into the ground in a fit of doom and vituperation, flopping around like a fish. Blanched up, turned completely white, which is what he'd been trying to do all his life anyway. Finally dug his heels into the ground, pushed himself up against a tree, gradually levered himself to a standing position, rocking back heel and toe, prepared to have at Idaho Blackie. And Blackie turned to him and said, "It's okay, you can keep the duck." Oh, I went to a bar and I asked for a drink. Gave me a glass and he showed me the sink. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. I'll end with a little poem. I've always regarded this as a poem. Anybody remember the name Mario Savio? The architect of the free speech fight, early 1960s in Berkeley, California. That's when some fellas came back from Mississippi doing voter registration during the Mississippi Freedom Summer. And one of them, Jack Weinberg, was passing out literature about what was happening in Mississippi on the plaza, Sproul Plaza there at the University of California in Berkeley. Well, they were busted. And that was the beginning of the free speech fight, see, because they were told they couldn't do that. Jack Weinberg was arrested and thrown in the back of a patrol car, handcuffed. And a reporter stuck a microphone through the window to interview him as he was lying on the seat there. You know what Jack Weinberg said? This is where that came from. Never trust anybody over 30. That's where that came from. I wonder what Jack would say today. Ask him. But, you know, the thing was that patrol car couldn't go anywhere because there were 5,000 University of California students around it that refused to let it move. And Mario Savio stood up on the top of that, on the top of one of that police car, and this is what he said. There comes a time when the operation of the machine is so odious that you cannot even tacitly participate. You've got to place your bodies on the gears, the levers, all the apparatus. And you've got to indicate to those who own it and those who run it that unless you are free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. Hallelujah, I'm a bomb. Hallelujah, bomb again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Oh, why don't you save all the money you earn? If I didn't need, I'd have money to burn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. See, I'm supposed to do one gig a month, but hell, you know, I've come a long way, so, and I have old friends in it, and things to learn, so I'm going to sing for the folks over there. As long as I don't have to be at the Woodward restaurant. I used their damn cookbook, you know. In fact, I put their cookbook in a whole tray full of enchilada sauce, and I put some onions, and I sliced up some eggplant and some fresh lime juice, and it was great, it was delicious. I like the cookbook a lot, but I ate there once. So some years ago, I went in there and and the food was terrible and the service was lousy. So I don't tell them I said that. What am I talking about this for? All right, this is my favorite song. I don't think I've sung it for a while. I'll make sure it's there. I got this song. Was given this song as a gift from a hill-crazed Mississippi poet and carpenter, a good poet, a good carpenter, the last of the true Shakers. You know, Shakers is not just a way to build furniture. It's a whole sensibility that endows everything they did. He gave me this song on the guarantee I would never utter his name in public. A passion for anonymity is so rare, isn't it? We'll see you again. When I was a young man, my father said to me, "Son, when you come of age, a carpenter you'll be." So when I come of age, I run away from home, saying, "Father, I must lay down your hammer and your nails for the tools of my own. Now I live in the forest where the wild deer run, and I never give a thought to my father's home." When I was a young man, my father said to me, "Son, when you come of age, a soldier you will be." So when I come of age, I run away from home, saying, "Father, I must lay down your sword and your gun for the weapons of my own. Now I live in the forest where the wild deer run, and I never give a thought to my father's home." Well, now there is a young man who calls himself my son. He'll step up and ask me, "Daddy, show me the way you come." And so I made this little song so I can plainly see that I don't look like a goddamn fool when he walks away from me. To live in the forest where the wild deer run and never give a thought to his father's home. Good night.